Hello!
Hello!
Welcome back. We are back. The ADHD Science Podcast rouses from its slumber of about 6 months.
Welcome.
It has been a while. There's lots of reasons why. We've been quite busy. You've been quite busy.
I haven't. Well, oh, wait, yes, I was. Guys, I've been quite busy.
Nothing secret, just kind of A-levels and having a job and stuff like that.
Yes, and stuff like that.
So we're going to talk, we've got six episodes lined up for you, all going to plan. So it'll be a six episode season.
The big 06.
yes, I don't know what the zero is doing there, but that's fine. Just six. And then we'll see how it goes next year. It slightly depends on your work and my work and all of that stuff. But the first person we're going to talk to is
Callie
Guinap.
Yes.
I think I pronounced her surname correctly. I apologise, Callie, if I have not. Callie is a psychiatrist, basically.
Yep.
She's affiliated to Harvard and she works at the Beth Israel Centre. She's talking about what's really interesting is we're an ADHD science podcast and the first episode of our second season is basically undermining ADHD in a way.
I don't know if that's how I'd phrase it. I think it's less undermining ADHD and more undermining the classification of ADHD itself.
I think that's right. It's questioning the diagnostic criteria. And I think if you think about the history of ADHD, it emerged as a pattern of observed behaviour. And now it's become seen as a way of your brain to be. So the experience of ADHD, which was never considered when it was actually when it was actually developed as a condition, is now coming to the fore. And so what Callie's work does is bring that almost like the chat and the sorts of things that are said within the community and put that into an academic paper and in an academic framework.
Yes, that is. I don't know what else to add to that. Yeah.
Sorry, but do you think? Because she talked about emotions much more than the kind.
Oh yeah, totally. I don't know. I only just woke up, man. But that's I promise I'm better in the episode.
You're very good in the episode, and as is Callie, and I am.
Oh, absolutely, Callie's great.
I am okay. So
you're slightly below average.
So let's listen to Callie.
Who's
right? Welcome, Callie. But thank you very much for coming on the ADHD Science Podcast. How are you doing?
Hi there. I'm doing fine. Thank you so much for having me.
No worries at all. So we'll jump straight into our first question about your fascinating research. Tess, if you can take it away.
I absolutely will take it away. So in your research, what question were you answering?
Yeah, so this paper was set out to answer what is the full breadth of symptoms that people with ADHD have, specifically young adults with ADHD, really looking at beyond what we typically think of just attention deficit or just hyperactivity, trying to get the full scope of symptoms that people experience. And we did that by asking people with ADHD what symptoms they experience.
Okay.
So it's a very like self-report basis then.
Yeah, it was a series of qualitative focus groups. So it was groups of between 3 to 6 people. It was all done remotely, so people could be from any country. And asking them, a series of questions that start, to start the conversation, but really letting the conversation flow in whatever direction it might take. Mm-hmm. And asking people, a few targeted questions on symptoms that I went into thinking that based off, my own experience having ADHD and having done research in the field before, things that had come to my attention as symptoms that are not currently really captured by the medical community. That people with ADHD say they experience all the time, but you're not going to find a paper on it. And that was kind of what this paper set out to do, was bring what people are talking about in ADHD communities into the formal scientific literature.
I think that is a very overdue topic, and it's something very important that you're looking at there, because there is a lot of things that people talk about and a lot of common symptoms that pop up across like online discussions particularly, mm-hmm. that no one really tends to take seriously, but a lot of people tend to agree on. What do you think about that, Dad?
Yeah, I mean, that's definitely, well, that's the thing that sort of turned me on to the paper myself, because it very much fits with my own experience, and also the experience of my own experience as a person with ADHD, but also my experience as a clinician looking after people with ADHD. Mm. You know, they talk about all sorts of things that aren't anywhere near the diagnostic criteria. So yes, that's the background, that mm-hmm. we all have this experience, and how do we turn that lived experience into something which is more scientific, which is exactly what you're doing in your paper. So, but before we go on to your findings, because some people might have their skepticism activated by a paper like this, because who did you talk to, who did you choose, and how do you make sure that you weren't importing finding what you wanted to find, in a sense? I'm not mm-hmm. saying you did, but just how did you make sure that that's not what happened?
Good question. Yeah, no, thank you. So for recruitment, recruited people from online communities for adults with ADHD. A lot of people came from Facebook. This was just me putting posts into groups for people with ADHD, or like from most people came from Facebook also, and some from like Reddit. Was pretty unsuccessful with my Twitter recruitment. And then also partnered with the Children and Adults with ADD, or CHAD, advocacy group, who posted the study on their platform.
Yes. And but that must have helped a lot.
Yes, most definitely. So people who were involved in some sort of community for people with ADHD. So that definitely does prime this study to be for people who have already had these conversations and already had these thoughts and already been primed with these ideas in these online communities, which some people might say is a problem with the study. I think of it as these are things that these communities are talking about, and it's important to know that. And so, it wasn't a random sample.
No, exactly. So you're not really aiming for a representative sample of everybody who has ADHD in the population.
That would be very, very
difficult. Well, apart from anything else, actually, I was just thinking about that. You know, lots of people with ADHD in the population aren't even diagnosed. So if you're trying to get, you're only ever going to get a representative sample of those who've managed to get a diagnosis.
Right. And this was people who had a diagnosis, and we were with like either they had documentation, or if I could like call their primary physician or something like that. Some people I wasn't able to verify their diagnosis, because sometimes, we're all guilty of this, it's very hard for offices to get back to every random person that calls. But everyone said that they had a formal diagnosis of ADHD and was able to verify diagnosis in the vast majority of people.
And the second part of the question, how did you ensure that the conversation that you went in, I mean, when you went in to do these conversations, how did you make yourself a bit more of a blank slate? I mean, it's almost a clinical question. It's almost a kind of question, you know, how do you do that?
Right. It's tricky. I went in with a preset discussion guide, and stuck to literally reading out that question. You know, when it came, the questions went in different orders based off how the conversation was flowing. But read the same questions to every group. To have a little bit more general, like, consistency in that, right? And then also really let actually the most difficult part was interrupting people at some point to move on to the next topic, because people really just were bouncing off, unsurprisingly, bouncing off each other and going in a lot of different directions. And so when analyzing the data, used an inductive approach called IPA, or Interpretive Phenomenological Analysis Framework, which you pull in everything that people say. So I didn't go into it saying like, oh, I'm only going to look at attention dysregulation and only, you know, bring in the results relevant to that. I brought in everything that people said, even if that had nothing to do with what I was originally asking.
So could you explain, because you whispered something to me about this IPA stuff.
Oh, no, I was talking about pale ale.
Oh, yeah, I was thinking that as well. It's a kind of beer.
All of
those. Oh, yes. It is also a kind of beer.
Also a kind of beer.
I'm sorry.
Non-UK listeners will not know that. May not know that.
Well,
I know, East Coast of America, there's quite a lot of IPA around, isn't
there? Most definitely. Yeah. Even more on the West Coast here.
All right, anyway.
Sorry about that. I promise I was listening.
I do not like sake.
I hear buzzwords and my brain goes.
Tess works in a pub, so she's working around IPA quite a lot. Speaking of things going off on a tangent, but what is your sense of the IPA? I mean, we don't necessarily need to have a technical discussion, but how do you turn a big mass of transcripts, presumably, of a conversation into something that makes sense?
Yeah.
And is kind of rigorous scientifically.
Yeah, it took a lot of time using a specific software for qualitative analysis that me and another researcher took the transcripts and we talked about them together to come up with like a preliminary main framework of like these were the main themes that came up. But and then from them separately without communicating with each other, went and coded everything. So having it like a theme and a sub theme and a sub sub theme and like divvying all the quotes into what bucket they fit in best. And as we did that, we were coming up with more themes and more groupings and more different ways to organize it separately. And so then we met together and then just like through discussions and, does this quote make sense in this bucket or did it belong somewhere else? Or does this grouping of whatever symptom under impulsivity, does that make sense here? Or is that actually more hyperactivity? And then came up with a new framework based off our discussion and went back and recoded everything under that.
Wow. So it's quite labor intensive in lots of ways.
Yeah. The project, I took a research year in medical school, which allowed me to do this project.
Okay.
Yeah. Not to, sorry. Oh, my brain's gone. Carry on.
You sure?
I was going to ask what kind of coding themes you had, but I thought that might lead on too soon to the second question.
Well, I can move. I think it's a good time.
Okay.
So what were your themes and what did you find?
Sorry. Yeah, so there were a lot of, I'll stick with like the main overarching themes and we can divvy into the sub-themes as we go. But the main themes that came out were attention dysregulation, as evidenced by the title of the paper. And then another large theme that emerged was emotional dysregulation. And under that, especially rejection sensitivity dysphoria. Hyperactivity and impulsivity were touched on a bit, but I find some of the less, they're mostly aligned with what the medical community already kind of knows about ADHD. And then how symptoms change over time from, with these adults reflecting back on when they were children and how different symptoms have manifested differently or how they've coped and things like that. So those are the main buckets that things fell into, but lots of sub buckets as well.
Yeah, well, let's explore the buckets. Let's have a dig around in the buckets, shall we? I mean, the key for me, from what the first bucket that you mentioned, attention dysregulation, I think that's what you said, because obviously the criteria say an attention deficit. Mm-hmm. So what's the difference?
Yeah, so that is, okay, before I answer that question, I just want to point out there's one other bucket I forgot to mention, which was perceptions on the diagnostic criteria themselves.
Okay.
We can circle back. Yeah. I just wanted to put that out there before I forgot. So the attention deficit would imply that you're bad at paying attention to things all of the time with everything, which I think all of us with ADHD know is not quite how that really works for us. People reported being able to hyper-focus or focus very well on topics that were of personal interest. And that, some people refer to that as their superpower. Like if I really care about something, if I'm hyper fixated on this topic, I can for hours and hours and hours, look into it or play this video game or, research on this, topic I find super interesting. And a lot of people find that very advantageous, but also it can come with its own problems. If you're so hyper focused on something that you find interesting, that you're neglecting other things that you should be doing. And a lot of people also reported time blindness during hyper-focusing where hours could go by and it felt like only 5 minutes.
Yeah.
Tess has got marked time blindness.
Well, it's that thing, isn't it, of not being able to focus on like an important assignment for more than like 30 seconds, but being able to go deep into researching some like ancient disease that no one's found the answer to for like... And then your dad calls you and is like, I called you for dinner like 3 hours ago. Where are you?
It's cold on the side.
Yeah, that's actually...
And I'm sad.
Something people reported a lot was kind of neglecting like basic life tasks, like remembering to eat was a very common thing that came up.
Yeah, and I mean, remembering to go to the toilet is a really common one in children. Obviously, I'm a pediatrician, so I don't, you know, that's my main main patient group. But I think... You know, it's just forgetting that to have not just to pay attention to things, but to pay attention to your own body is a really interesting kind of aspect of that. Unfortunately, you don't see that much in young adults. It's good. It's fair to say. So, yeah. So I think that it already challenges the concept, how ADHD is conceptualized, isn't it? Because it's conceptualized as a deficit in attention, which really increasingly doesn't make sense.
Right.
And the second thing, I mean, the emotional dysregulation, well, I talk about it a lot, but please tell us what your group said about emotional dysregulation, because I don't want to jump in with all of my, we're not interviewing me.
We can, but we found that a lot of people reported really intense emotions that were able to fluctuate very quickly. So like kind of going from 0 to 100 in either positive or negative directions. And a lot of people's, that was like the main like dysregulation part of it. But under that, a lot of people express difficulty either communicating their emotional feelings to others, like finding words to describe them, or struggling to conceal their emotions. You know, other people said it was hard to, you know, not show their emotions to others, you know, their face, like not having a poker face at all. We also found that a lot of people found difficulty feeling their emotions in the moment. As you were mentioning, a disconnect from your body, a disconnect from feeling what emotions you're feeling and having difficulty naming them, or alexithymia, not being able to name or discuss what feelings you're having in that moment.
Alexithymia is very interesting and also one of the best words in the English language. It's So as you say, it's the difficulty with expressing and explaining your own emotions. And it's often thought of as something that's kind of something more of an autistic trait. But I think it's increasingly clear that it's common in ADHD as well. And that's disconnect, isn't it? Another theme that's coming up.
Could you give a quick example of the Alexa thing?
Alexithymia.
I forgot the second part of the word.
Callie, do you want to give an example?
So like an example could be, I'm going to make up a situation right now, but let's say one of you says something very either mean or nice to me at this moment, and I start having an emotional reaction to that, but I'm not able to put words to what's happening. I might notice like I'm having an emotional reaction, but it's hard for me to say, or it might even be hard for me to realize I'm having an emotional reaction, but I can't name what that is. I can't say I am angry, I am flattered, I am... And like oftentimes people, when they look back, whether that be hours or days later, can say, oh, I was feeling this, but couldn't do that in the moment.
That makes a lot of sense, you know.
It is. And the question is whether it's primarily to do with the fact that you're just finding the emotion so overwhelming because of your dysregulation, or whether it's due to something more cognitive to do with how you are naming your own feelings. And it's very, very difficult to know which one of that is. Yeah. And it's probably a mixture of both, to be honest.
Right. I'd love for more research trying to figure out the answer to that question.
Yeah, exactly. Because, I mean, how would you... Well, I suppose you'd have to have hot and cold situations where you're actually feeling versus labelling and try and match those two up. Do you see what I mean? Trying to label situations and what I'm feeling or what I would be feeling in that situation versus...
There's all kinds of external stuff happening there as well, isn't there?
Yeah.
It'd be very difficult to do, but...
Yeah, but that's psychology, isn't it?
Well, yes, Dad.
Thank you. That's the first yes, Dad of the new of this series. Tell us more about RSD. It has come up before, I think briefly, but I don't think we've had a proper discussion of RSD recently on the podcast. So let's dig in a little bit into that.
Okay. So RSD, or rejection sensitivity dysphoria, is, as
the name kind of explains, feeling overly sensitive to feelings of rejection, which a lot of most people in the study reported. And something that was really interesting is that they recognized that their emotions were out of proportion to the situation, but they still weren't able to control that response. They still felt as dysphoric, even though they thought, oh, they didn't even mean to exclude me. Like, I understand this is not a personal attack, but I still feel that it is. And a lot of triggers for RSD were, you know, perceived social exclusion or abandonment, or even like receiving negative feedback at work, or like academic underperformance triggered this rejection sensitivity. And I'll pause there for a moment.
No, I mean, I find it really interesting. I mean, I've done a little, when I've done a little bit of reading around, two questions really spring to mind for me. One is, do you think that RSD is more common in people with ADHD than the general population? And if so, why?
Yeah, excellent question. That was answered in part by some of the study participants, that yes, I do think it's more common among people with ADHD, although it's definitely not exclusive to people with ADHD. It also comes up, everyone feels this sometimes, but it comes up clinically also in borderline personality disorder and atypical depression. So it's definitely not an exclusively ADHD phenomenon. However, I do think people with ADHD experience it more than the general population. And this is speculated on by a few of the study participants. A few people said that this could be RSD, a learned response to like getting rejected repeatedly over their like developmental years because they're neurodivergent, because they don't fit in as well with like the main social fabric, and kind of learning like, oh, I'm going to be rejected because I've been rejected before. So I'm like hyper like aware of this happening again. It's speculative, but it could.
And then there's the emotional dysregulation itself, which gives you that feeling of you're sensitive to rejection and you feel it really intensely, even though you can at some level remove yourself from that feeling and kind of get a bit of objectivity from it and kind of perspective on it and say, well, I know this isn't anything personal, but I really feel terrible about it.
I mean,
the third bucket, which seems a smaller bucket, more of a kind of bowl. One of those little buckets that kids have on the beach.
I was thinking like the trick-or-treating buckets with the pumpkins.
Trick-or-treating buckets these days are massive. There's nothing small about trick-or-treating buckets anymore. Not like when I was a boy, when trick-or-treat was not a thing. Back in the good old days. Anyway, I like trick-or-treating.
RSD goes quite beautifully in hand with impulsivity, doesn't it? Because you do something impulsive, you don't quite get the reaction that you expect.
So the little bucket we're talking about is the hyperactivity and impulsivity bucket.
I've just cut you off, haven't I?
No, that's fine. Sorry. But just to clarify to the listeners that's what we're all talking about. We all understand what we're talking about.
You said that opens up another bucket and I didn't even let you say what the bucket was. Anyway, what I was thinking.
We know from clinical practice and from all the studies over time that the hyperactivity of a young child tends to turn into something that looks quite different in adults, doesn't it? What do your participants experience in terms of what their hyperactivities turned into?
Right. Yeah. Like you said, most people didn't experience like Frank, running around in the way that they did when they were children, and some never experienced that. But a lot of people reported that it turned into this like mental hyperactivity or like racing thoughts, as opposed to a physical need to move around. It was that their mind couldn't stay in one place. Is how they described that.
It's more of an internalized restlessness.
Yes. Like feeling restless, but not in a way that was helped necessarily by walking around.
Yeah.
Yes, I mean, I suppose, and the it's interesting, isn't it? Because in younger children, the advice is to sort of walk it off when you're feeling restless, to kind of get a bit of exercise. And I think exercise probably is helpful for adults, but in a different way, maybe more in an emotional way.
And I think if the restlessness that you're feeling is a psychological thing rather than a physical thing, then walking's not necessarily going to help, because that walking can be very understimulating.
So thinking about all the thoughts that we've had so far about how people experience ADHD versus the criteria,
mm-hmm.
what thoughts do people have in your focus groups about what the criteria should be? What's wrong with it, and what needs to change?
Yeah, so a lot of people felt that the current, you know, trifecta of inattention, hyperactivity, and impulsivity was very limiting. That there should be more criteria in addition to those criteria themselves. Like, for example, inattention not even accurately capturing the experience, but, you know, really expanding out to, you know, capturing things that we talked about, like the emotional dysregulation, hyper-focusing, things like that. Also, if you, at least in the United States, for the criteria that it's made for children, and we don't have updated yeah. guidelines for adults. So it leads to a lot of wording that was seen as like infantilizing, such as like, is this developmentally appropriate? Well, some of these people are 30 yes. years old. They're like, what does developmentally appropriate mean for me?
Exactly.
And so those were kind of some of the main buckets for that we need to expand it. And also, this kind of gets into some data I put in to a different paper, but saying that a lot of the way we diagnose mental illness and mental health conditions in right now is focusing on how these symptoms present externally to the person who's evaluating you, yeah. or like how does yeah. it present yeah. to the other people in your life, as opposed to what does it present to me for the experience of feeling it. That's not something that we capture really very well, I think, in how we diagnose things. And there are reasons, of course, to try to have more objectivity with how someone can evaluate you, to be like, is this person acting in this way? Is this person reporting, you know, how in this more interpersonal external kind of presentation? But I think it really lacks that more nuanced, like, subjective experience of what it might mean to feel something. And I think an example for this could be, as we were talking about time blindness earlier, someone, you know, in a more clinical way might say patient was late to the appointment, whereas, you know, that's kind of an external and also the kind of value judgment. As opposed to saying I experienced the passage of time differently is like a different way to frame that same thing, framing it more like as what the person is actually experiencing.
I mean, it seems to me pretty obvious that at some point things are going to have to change mm-hmm. in terms of diagnostic criteria, and particularly for adults.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think one of the things that you said is that people want additions to the criteria? Did anyone say, well, just throw it all out and start again?
Oh, so not explicitly in those words, although I think that if I would have this is me speculating, but I think if I would have proposed that, people would have been receptive to that idea. But that's, as you mentioned earlier, the framing. I was framing, how do we think about these current criteria? What do you think could be better? So I think that's why those are the kind of answers that I got.
And I mean, my brain's going in all sorts of different directions.
I wonder why.
I mean, one of the criticisms that people might, but one of the things that people come back with when you say, well, we would like to add these other things into mm-hmm. the diagnostic criteria is, well, are they specific enough? And there's kind of, there's a difference between appreciating within a population, you know, people with ADHD have a lot of emotional dysregulation. We need mm-hmm. to find things to help with that
mm-hmm.
versus we think emotional dysregulation should be a criteria for the condition. Right. Because if it's not that specific to the condition, it doesn't help.
Right. No, I completely hear that. And I think that we need, this is kind of a cop-out answer, but I think that we need more research to figure out exactly how, because my study is very preliminary. It's, you know, just me asking some people who signed up for my study what they're experiencing. We need more generalizable studies. So like, is alexithymia something that is, you know, we know it's people outside of ADHD experience it, but how many people with ADHD do experience it, and how specific is it exactly? getting at like the more psychometric properties of these other symptoms. So I think it is too early for me to say like, oh, all of these should be 100% in the diagnostic criteria, because as you mentioned, how specific are they? Or how even sensitive are they for ADHD? So I think that it's yet to be determined, but I think that part of what my study set out to do is kind of lay the groundwork for these questions to be answered down the road by more, you know, large scale, more like quantitative methods.
Should we go on?
So what does this mean for people working with ADHD people? So like clinicians, parents, anything like that?
Yeah, I think it means that first off, if someone says they have ADHD, don't assume that that only means the three, you know, the trifecta of the three symptoms. Have an open mind. I think that this person is probably experiencing a lot more than that in ways that affect lots of different facets, probably every facet of their lives. Like their interpersonal relationships, how they function at school, how they function at work. I guess we already kind of think about how people function at school and work. But I feel like a lot less is captured on people's like relationship with others and their relationship with themselves. So I think having a bit of an open mind with that mentality and not like putting everything into like check boxes per se. Yes, we check a lot of boxes in medicine, like that is something that we have to do, but I feel like having a little bit more fluidity in your approach. And you know, I think a lot of this comes into if you're looking at it from a more like psychotherapy perspective, being able to explore like all of these different, how ADHD affects all these different facets, and like how much of this is, and like a lot of people have more existential concerns, like what is me, what is the ADHD, what can I even disentangle these two things? I think there's a lot of work to be done with there. Is that what you were asking exactly?
I think so. Yeah.
I think so. Yeah. I mean, I think I suppose my question is, you're a clinician, you're now practicing.
Yeah.
What do you do to help people who have ADHD, who you are patients with, their emotional dysregulation? You know, we know kind of how to treat the core symptoms, the hyperactivity, blah, blah, blah. But how do you help people with emotional dysregulation as a doctor?
Yeah, I think that part of it, even just naming that, like, that is something that's going on that we think might be related to ADHD can be very validating for people to hear. Even just, like, thinking that, like, they're alone in this and this is just them by themselves. I think that helping connect people to support groups, whether they be online or otherwise, can be really helpful for people to process these emotions with others who are also experiencing similar emotions. A big proponent of group therapy for people with ADHD. I think that can be really helpful in normalizing and hearing from others who are experiencing the same thing, how they've coped with these strategies, with these emotions.
And sort of moving on to RSD, because people, it's not something that's diagnosed specifically in the UK. We wouldn't necessarily talk about it as a diagnosis in and of itself. So what guidance can you give to people who kind of feel they might be, this might be a problem, a big problem for them?
Yeah, giving a name to the experience can be really helpful to help people describe that that's what they're feeling. I also think, like, really helping reiterate, like, to not take things as personally and really thinking that, you know, I'm a complicated person that does things for a lot of different reasons, and so is this other person. They have a lot are there a million reasons why they might not have like responded to my text or whatever the situation is. Like, it doesn't necessarily mean it's because they hate me. They could have so much going on in their lives. Kind of like humanizing the other person can be really helpful, especially because these are situations are often between people that they care about deeply, because that's, you know, when rejection hurts the most. And thinking like, and being able to form relationships that you are confident in and can, you know, be like, I know that they care about me deeply. And if they're not responding to me, it's not an attack. I trust that if there was a problem in our relationship, that they would bring it up more directly.
I mean, I know that I can't apply my own experience to everyone who has ADHD, but I do find that rationalizing can be quite helpful in these situations. Like, you know, maybe this person didn't laugh at my joke because they're still worrying about the joke that they made 5 minutes ago that people didn't laugh.
Yes, you know? That's a very good example.
It's that exactly. whole thing. And it is especially helpful when you have friends who are also neurodivergent and very open about what's going on in their own brains. Because then you can apply what you know about them. But if it's in a situation where you don't know them so well, like maybe it's someone you've just sat next to and you really want them to think you're cool.
Yeah.
You know, that's when you don't really know what to do because you don't know enough about the person to think about it from their perspective.
Yeah. And you don't know. Yeah. And you don't know what's going on in for them at that moment. Are they and what they might be projecting all sorts of things on you as well, which aren't about you.
Yeah. That last bit didn't really make any sense to me, but I'm just going to pretend it did.
Well, okay. So for example, you're sitting next to somebody and you want them to, you know, you're just being friendly.
Yeah.
They might think that you're doing something else entirely. They might think that you're trying to trick them or trying to get something from them, or you know what I mean.
Well, what if I am though?
What if you are exactly? So I'm saying is, if there's hostility or rejection from somebody else, it may be nothing to do with how you've approached the situation. It may be everything to do with how they're interpreting and seeing the situation.
Exactly, but again, I know that this doesn't work for everyone.
No, of course not. But it's a very common.
It's a good thing to try. That's for sure.
It's a universal experience in life generally to have these experiences. I mean, we're not saying, and I think any of us are saying that's unique to ADHD people. But I think ADHD people, for the reasons we've outlined, feel those situations far more acutely.
Callie, could I ask? Would it be right to say that Callie, would it be right to say that it's not true that most people who have RSD have ADHD, but the most people who have ADHD have symptoms of RSD?
Oh, interesting. Yeah, I think I got what you're saying. I think that
Don't think it made much sense.
No, I think it did. I think there are a lot of people who have RSD for a lot of different reasons, and they may or may not have ADHD. But I think a lot of people with ADHD do have RSD.
That's a much better way to put it.
There you go. Well, you've just clarified it. That's absolutely fine. So let's move on to our fourth question.
Oh, you want me to read it?
Oh, I get mine. That's so traditional.
What does this mean for ADHD people themselves? I feel like we've kind of just touched on this, but in a more general sense.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that, kind of to summarize a little bit of what we've been talking about, I think it means that what I'm trying to get at is like you aren't alone in the things that you are experiencing, even if they aren't currently captured by the medical community, that there are a lot of people with ADHD experiencing similar things, and that we'd recommend like reaching out for, like, you know, obviously most of us with ADHD have people in our families who are also have ADHD because that's how this works, but also, you know, reaching out to people in general to form these networks I think can be really important. I think also just being aware that, like, having to, you know, bring some awareness to, like, oh, I am experiencing this, you know, intense emotion, and being like, that is something that I do, and that's okay, but how do I cope with this? Being able to, like, kind of break down the things that might be causing you distress from your ADHD symptoms or from other people's perception of your ADHD symptoms, and, like, break them down bit by bit and see how you can manage each one individually.
Yeah. I've just been thinking about is what it means for maybe young people, maybe children or adolescents who are just, you know, kind of getting their ADHD diagnosis. And I think one of the things that, you know, we often say, I don't know what you say when you kind of maybe diagnosing somebody at 12 or 13 or when you were diagnosed at 14?
15.
Okay.
14? Yeah. I should definitely know this.
18 of some kind. you know, what's going to change? One of the really interesting questions is, what's this going to look like in 10 years' time, 15 years' time?
Right.
And I think that's something that's kind of valuable to have that kind of data about, well, these are a group of people in the next generation up, but this is how they experience their ADHD at this point.
Right. No, thank you for asking. I think that we're all probably on the same page that, you know, it used to be that ADHD was something that they thought everyone just grows out of, and then you're, you know, once you're an adult, it's gone. I think we're all aware that that's not quite how this works. That I think for the majority of people, ADHD is something that still affects you throughout your lifespan. It might not be in the same ways as it did when you were a child. And that can be for a few different reasons. Some of that could just be like neurodevelopmentally growing out of some of the symptoms. Other parts of that can be developing coping skills that, you know, this symptom that you had that was causing you problems all the time, like losing your keys. Well, now you have a system to keep your keys in place, so it's not causing problems anymore. The underlying disorganization that you have hasn't changed, but your way of coping with it has. Some of that also could be, you know, creating environments that you are more likely to flourish in as an adult. You know, a lot of people, like in the school system, it's like too constrictive or restrictive, that it being able to have more room for creativity and flexibility in your adult life can be helpful for some. I'm someone who needs a lot of structure in my life personally. I do not do well when there's too many possible, like I need a calendar of my day that plans it out personally, but like I'm able to plan that in my life, having what time I set aside for certain things, and that helps, you know, create, have my environment be something I can flourish in better. So I think that, and then also through, you know, medications, through therapy, through, you know, other ways of coping can also make things a lot easier as an adult. But sometimes also, you know, added stressors of adulthood come in, you know, there's taxes and bills and everything that you have to deal with as an adult that you didn't have and to worry about as a kid. Your own,
that's very stressful. Very stressful. Yeah. I can't tell you. Particularly if all three of them have ADHD as well.
Yeah. So like sometimes so I think it's an oversimplification to say things only get easier as an adult. I think there are new stressors that can arise that, you know, you haven't confronted before, that you're now coping with ADHD in this certain situation for the first time as an adult.
I think one of the things, I agree with all of that, but I think the one thing that I always think about is that you're very powerless as a child, and you sort of that's kind of okay because children aren't bothered by their lack of power, but you're incredibly powerless as an adolescent, I think, in society.
Mm-hmm.
You are.
Yeah.
And you're having to deal with all of this while being effectively just being told what to do all the time.
Mm-hmm.
Which is really difficult. And one of the things that I think is easier about ADHD as you're an adult is simply to do, you are more valued by society. Mm. The lighting on our but we are, you are more valued.
Exposure just got ramped way up. Way it's up. Crazy.
But you are more valued by society. Your skills are more valued. You will find a niche where your skills, you know, your weaknesses will be downplayed, and your strengths will be up. Emphasize.
I mean, we talk about this a lot.
It makes it easier.
We talk about this a lot when it comes to the school system, like the fact that it's very much, it takes a one size fits all approach.
Yeah.
And I think in ADHD, like this is just an example. I mean, this happens with all kinds of people, right? But specifically in ADHD, I feel like sometimes the strengths that we have don't quite line up with the strengths that the school system expect us to have.
But I'm going to ask Callie about this, and you don't only say what you're comfortable saying, but as a resident with ADHD in psychiatry, which can't be that easy, how do you manage? How do you cope with your ADHD and everything medicine demands of you?
Yeah, so I find personally it's easier as now than it was when I was in elementary school, and that's because I have a lot more access and awareness of ways to cope than I did when I was, you know, a young child and had no idea about any of this. I wasn't diagnosed until I was 19. And so part of that, medications I just find incredibly helpful in being able to, you know, do my work and in orders that I need to. But I also find that having a little bit of time where I can like reflect on what's going on. And like, this is like stuff that's for anyone in psychiatry, but I find it also helpful for in ADHD, especially like on the like commute back home after work, really reflecting on, you know, everything that's piling up during the day. A lot of patients have incredibly sad situations that they're in. That's the norm instead of the exception, especially since I'm working on inpatient psych right now. And so being able to reflect back on, you know, what about am I carrying home with me from work today? And how much of that can I leave at work, and how much do I need to like process further? Because I think part of it, and again, this isn't specific to ADHD, but I feel like that's one of the biggest things that I need in my work. I think also, like in terms of task prioritization, I find it like if I have 10 tasks, like a lot of people might find it easier to start with the hardest one first. I find that exhausting. Like, get rid of like 3 super easy tasks as like a warm up. You know, if it's just like a quick or like something I need to put in or something I need to like really quickly, knock that out of the way first. Now you only have like 3 tasks left, or however many it is.
And even though they're harder. And do you do the thing, and I admit that I do this, you do the thing, you do a thing where you put something on your list of tasks that you've already done.
Yeah.
So you can cross it off.
Immediately take it off.
I mean,
I'm making progress.
An empty to-do list is very overwhelming.
Yeah. I'm just thinking, I'm obviously thinking about you and your room, which is a task in itself.
You do not need to bring this up.
It's a sore point between us. It's basically the one thing we fight about.
Yeah.
More or less. Oh, well, never mind. So let's not talk about it, shall we? Callie, what is your next research question? What's the thing that you want to research next? Do you want to kind of look into next in your career?
Yeah, so I'm on a little bit of a... Oh, did you remember the question?
Yes.
Maybe ask it now.
Yeah, go for it. Yeah, wait, seize the moment. Go on, Tess.
Okay. it was something along the lines of... Oh, yeah. Okay. So I did have a question about the research that I probably should have mentioned earlier, and it was that you mentioned that you started off with a set of categories that you expected to come up, mm-hmm. right, when you were having the discussions. Was there anything that came up during those discussions that you weren't expecting, that you had to kind of create this whole new category for because you just, you know?
Yeah, no, thank you. I think a few of, like, the one that's coming to mind immediately is, like, alexithymia. I had not thought about that in the context of ADHD for this study at all, but it came up multiple times in different focus groups. And, like, also the way that people communicate their emotions with other people wasn't something I was coming in here expecting to talk about, but it came up time and time again. So, like, time blindness. So a lot of the findings that we're talking about, I knew about, but I wasn't thinking about for this study, and the participants brought them up many times over. So yeah, those are the main findings I think jumped out on their own.
Okay.
Cool. Do you want to ask the last question?
Yeah.
Okay.
So what is your next research question? What's the thing that you want to find out next about ADHD or ADHD? So
this is I think one of the things I want, like, this isn't so much research, but I think one of the important next steps is coming up with like guidelines for diagnosis of adult ADHD for the United States, because we don't have that currently. So that's not like research per se. Like, it's something that needs to be done for next steps.
Absolutely.
So I think that's definitely one aspect. I think in terms of like a project, this is very like still just like in the back of my brain simmering around. I haven't made any actionable steps on this yet. But I think that it's like within near the ADHD community, there's a lot of discussion about the ways that ADHD is similar to and different from autism, that I feel like, you know, in there's seems like 2 very different things medically that have, you know, they used to be diagnostically exclusive. You used to not be able to be diagnosed with both. And now it's, you know, it's even, you know, discussed as like, oh, is this like a continuum? Are these like part of a spectrum with each other? How much of these are just co-diagnosed? How much of these, like, what about them is different? I think there's like a, like, getting a group of people who have ADHD and autism, so people have one and not the other, and really exploring like that, like, what is actually unique to each of these diagnoses, and how much of these overlap.
Yeah, and that's a fascinating area. I mean, obviously there's research on that in children in terms of behavior, but moving that to the subjective experience of adults with these conditions. I mean, you know, in a way, that's because before we did the ADHD Science podcast, we did Extraordinary Brains, where we basically interviewed, got the life stories of people with autism / ADHD / another neurodiversity.
Mm-hmm.
And in a sense, I mean, I'm not saying that Extraordinary Brains is anything like a kind of research project, but but actually, in a way, we've got that's what we collected. We collected in a very uncontrolled way. We collected that data because we ended up with lots of people with both, some with one, some with the other.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, ADHD and autism were the things that did tend to come up quite a lot on that podcast, but there was also all kinds of stuff we looked at. We talked to some people with dyslexia, you know, all these kind of things.
Oh, well, never mind. Well, that's fab. I think we've pretty much done. I think we're going to leave any further discussion to another time because that's what we need. We'll do a bit in a minute where we just thank you and say goodbye. Unless is there anything else that you wanted to kind of reflect on or think about that comes from our discussion today?
I think you two have been completely wonderful. I think I've touched on everything that I came in here wanting to make sure that I said. So thank you so much.
Okay, great. Well, Callie, thank you so much for joining us, and hopefully we can get together again because I know I have a rumor that there's some other interesting stuff about social media that you have under your hat as well. But I think we've exhausted ourselves for today, and we need to go away and edit the hell out of this. thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye. Thank you so much.
Okay, so that was Callie.
Sure was.
Tess wants to change the format in a way that I don't want to do.
I'm sorry. We discussed having a thing at the start where after the intro we go, who's that at the door?
And I'm too old and boring to think that that's fun. So let's do a vote. If you want us to start saying who's that at the door, please contact us via the ADHD UK charity on Twitter, Facebook,
And contact us there if you want anything else. Just text us.
There is
we're available.
There's a feedback section on the website. There's a section for the podcast on the ADHD UK website.
Yep.
And while you're there, look at all the excellent work that ADHD UK charity is doing
and
for check people.
Out Callie.
And check out Callie, whose social media we will post in the episode.
She was very
description.
Good and very interesting. And thank you, Callie.
And hopefully we'll get her on again when she's going to talk about social media.
Woo!
All right. That's enough gassing from us. Goodbye!
And not enough gassing yet from our dog, apparently, who smells really bad.
More on that as we get it. Bye!